Welcome to the Elemental Awakening.
Okay, welcome everyone to another episode of Elemental Awakening. Today I have a special guest, Justin Mares. He is from Kettle and Fire, Perfect Keto, and a bunch of other things too. I get his newsletter all the time. It just amazes me all the things that he's involved in. He's a super interesting guy, super smart, down to earth, and super healthy as well. So Justin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ben. Excited to be here.
Yeah, excited to have you on. So me and Justin met, I'd say, just under a year ago in New York at an interesting sound and psychedelic type event where we sort of went on a bit of a journey together. And, you know, just became friends. We ended up rooming together with our good friend of ours, Robbie, who's also been on the podcast as well. And, you know, as I was just learning more about Justin, what he does, it really blew me away about how young he is and how he's been able to scale a few companies very successfully. And myself coming from the food industry, I know how challenging that can be. So yeah, I guess just introduce yourself to our audience. Just tell me a bit about who you are and how you got into doing all the things that you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. So to start it, kind of the two main businesses, I would say, are Kettle and Fire and Perfect Keto. Kettle and Fire is like a bone broth and soup brand. And Perfect Keto is a company that we started about almost 4 years ago now. That's like food and supplements for people on a ketogenic diet. And so I kind of got into this stuff. I was in the tech industry previously and doing anything in food. And as I was in that industry, I was like working with this amazing founder who I learned a ton from. So I don't have any regrets, but like we were working on growing a developer tools company, which is basically like selling software to software developers. And though the business was really successful, it was certainly not a business that I thought was like really that compelling. I didn't really love the industry. I didn't really think, and like, honestly, I didn't really think we were making that much of a difference. It's like great that people are buying our product versus someone else's product. There's some sort of like fun element of competition to that, but I definitely did not feel like, oh man, this stuff is changing the world. If people use our software and not this other software, like we're totally like fighting the good fight here. And so coming out of that kind of experience, I decided I wanted to do something in an area that I cared about, which like for me is the health and wellness space. And so I was doing a lot of CrossFit, had a bunch of friends that were doing like paleo, you know, keto stuff. And specifically a lot of them were looking for bone broth to help with like joint, gut, and kind of skin health. And so I tried to buy some. At the time I was a terrible cook and I like couldn't find a quality source anywhere. So I was like, cool, let's like start this as a side business with my then 18-year-old brother. And the business just like kind of took off on us, and then saw a similar opportunity about a year later, and we decided to launch Perfect Keto with a different partner. But yeah,
so, so when you say just started, like you just started selling products, like how does that like just start is very sounds simple, but what was that? Like just wanted to start
totally
products online. Yeah, tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, so we so for Kettle and Fire specifically, that was like my first foray into the food business. And so Perfect Keto was a little bit easier. It had some contacts, some connections. But with Kettle and Fire, like we literally called or emailed almost 500 different manufacturing partners just to find like one that could actually make our product. Like we have, if you're looking at, you know, sort of the bone broth category, if you look at like what our competitors do versus what we do, you know, they're all doing like much shorter cook times. They're doing much lower quality bones. And they're not using like acids. There's a couple like different processing things that we do, which make our product uniquely challenging. Like for finding a co-packer, you know, they're basically going, okay, I can work with this company that will take, you know, I'll cook their stuff for like 4 hours, package it up out the door. They pay me a fee. And you guys are asking me to cook this stuff like 24 hours. Like that's tying up all my equipment, all my people, all my labor for an entire day. Like that's a big ask. And so it was really, really hard for us to find a co-packer. But after like calling and emailing almost 500, it was gnarly. Yeah, it was gnarly. And then, funny enough, so my brother, who's my co-founder in the business, he, like I said, was 18 at the time, decided to kind of take a gap year to do this business before going to college. And he emailed Mark Cuban from Shark Tank, from US Shark Tank, and was like, hey, I'm 18. I'm trying to find like a co-packer to help with this business that I'm getting off the ground. And Mark Cuban actually responded, put us in touch with his food team, who then introduced us to our co-packer that we like still work with today.
Wow.
So Mark Cuban sort of sourced our co-packer, which like we used to get off the ground and we still work with, which is kind of nuts.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Wow, that's like a long shot. You know, you just, I guess after calling 500, you're kind of like, let me just shoot some like, that's really cool.
Yeah. We were definitely like, we're going to do whatever, email whoever, this is such a pain.
And so like, I guess perseverance is a really key attribute, you know, as an entrepreneur, you know, and I guess most people might give up at like 10 calls or like 20 calls, you know, what kept you going after, you know, 250 calls and not finding a co-packer? Was there ever a point where like, hey, you know, maybe we should just scrap this idea, it's not possible? Or was it like, no, we're going to keep going until we find it if it takes forever? Like, tell me that process, because I find that quite interesting.
Yeah, so there's definitely a point where we thought about that. I think one of the things that was most compelling about it is like, before we launched Kettle and Fire, I actually like put up a landing page and started kind of like driving some ads, basically saying like, hey, we have bone broth with these attributes at these price point, like this is kind of the brand. And doing that, we saw such a tremendous response from people that were like wanting bone broth. And
so before you had a co-packer, you're already seeing like testing the first demand.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before we had a product, we basically validated and seen that this is something like people really wanted, and people were willing to pay for a product that like we told them didn't exist yet, but would probably exist in 6 months. And they were willing to like pay quite a lot for it. And from like talking to these people who wanted this product, we were just like, we found out more and more that a lot of these customers were like drinking this daily. They wanted, you know, it was just like, it was something that they really, really wanted. And so given that, I had just seen like such strong validation signals doing this test that I was like, man, we really have to figure this out, because if we can get to the bottom of it, you know, there's like a pretty material business to be built here, and a product that I think a lot of people will really enjoy.
And there's a cliche saying, like, if it was easy, anyone would do it, right? And
yeah,
I guess that's true. The key here, right? Because like, just no one had figured that out yet.
Totally, man.
I love the fact that you're testing before launching. And I think, you know, my friend Robbie talks a lot about that. And I think this comes from a lot of like the tech sort of side. It's like, knowing your customer, finding out like what they really want, you know, how much did that initial testing sort of change the product offering or how you looked at the business? Was there anything you found out about, you know, how you were going to launch this in that process?
Yeah, I mean, it changed a lot. It changed, it gave us confidence, you know, to give you a sense, like our first order, because of the type of manufacturing we do, our minimum order quantities is what they're called. It's like the minimum amount of product we can order are quite high. And so that test allowed us to give us confidence to do a couple of things. One, we could see like what people are willing to pay for it. We knew that we could, and we used that to like back out to a margin structure that we knew would be compelling. The second thing is that it allowed us to run numbers, and I could see like, okay, if we're spending $5,000 a month on advertising, that ad word, like that chunk of advertising is going to drive X amount of sales. And so I kind of ran like a math equation that allowed me to see like, okay, if we place a minimum order quantity, our minimum order quantities were $100,000 roughly at the time. And so to start the business, like I had to come out of pocket with money that I had personally just to like put $100,000 into this. And so running that validation test gave me the confidence to put $100,000 of this business that was like brand new, because I could kind of run the numbers and say like, okay, if we spend $5,000 a month on ads, like we'll be able to sell $120,000 worth of product. And like, even if this doesn't take off, the worst case, I should get my money back at the least, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting approach. Cause a lot of people I know in the food business that are starting out are passionate about a product, and they start by doing these little shows, they start building up their sort of volume slowly. This was like, hey, we know there's some demand, a bit of risk involved, but you sort of mitigated some of your risk by, you know, just testing and seeing what an ad would turn around. So I love that.
Yeah.
So what would you suggest to someone launching a product? Like, should they really focus on like that kind of like pre-testing stuff? Like, how important do you think that is for someone else? Or if you were ever to do it again with a different, totally different product category. Would you follow a similar sort of playbook?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that it's really important. I think that it's important for two reasons. It's important on the one hand, because like you want to make sure that you're selling something that people actually want. That's key. But on the other hand too, it's like, even if you know that you're selling a product, let's say I was launching another coffee brand, like I don't necessarily need to run ads to validate that people drink coffee. Like that clearly happens it's a multi-billion dollar category. Like you can just know that if you make the best coffee, someone's going to buy it. But what I think is really useful about validating these things is you get to have actual conversations with people that are or are going to become your customers, which will totally transform the way that you market, talk about the product, all that. Like when we started Kettle and Fire, you know, we were kind of building it for me, like someone who's in health, someone who's like paleo, like someone who does CrossFit and is sort of like a health optimizer, if you want to call it that. And what we found from like talking to our early customer base is that like none of our early customers, or very few, were actually like male health optimizers. They were almost all females who were looking to use bone broth to improve like gut, skin, or joint health. And so we changed the messaging from like healthy way to get a lot of protein to like an easy way to get like collagen, amino acids, and the things that like help your gut, skin, and joint health. And that's a really big shift from a messaging standpoint. That,
huge.
Yeah, that like we wouldn't have known had we not like started testing this early on.
And so what would you say were like the main ways to test it? It was just getting feedback, or was it like you get the analytics from your ads to see who's actually clicking and looking?
Yeah, I mean, so it was analytics, but it was also just like when someone ordered a product that didn't exist on a shitty landing page after clicking an ad to like buy bone broth, like I just reached out to those people and was like, hey, like no one should be buying this. Like this is a terrible website. This is a terrible page. Like product doesn't exist. Like you basically got tricked. Why do you want this product so badly that it was something you're willing to like plug your credit card into on a like less than ideal website? And so I just wanted to talk to those people and hear like, what are the reasons that this is something you want so much that you're willing to check out on a very mediocre website, you know, and would just talk to them.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing I've learned the last few years is like, I have no idea, although I used to think I knew a lot about like what people want. I think certain things, but the reality is much different from what I think, because I view things based on what I see from my perspective, but what's out there is way, way different. So that's interesting. That was sort of my next question. What was like one of the most surprising things you learned, you know, that you didn't think or you couldn't see? Was there anything else that really stood out as you were sort of initial launching that you're like, wow, I would have never thought this?
That was a really big one. And then specific to, there's a lot of like nuance to the food industry. Like I had, specifically one thing I remember is talking to an advisor at the time who the business was kind of like growing. We were like that year, I think we tripled. And as the business was growing, I was like, hey, Brad, like we're doing super well. We just had our best month ever. This month is looking like it's going to be our best month ever. And he was like, you know, how much cash do you have in the bank? And I told him, and I was like, oh yeah, we have like 100 grand or something. We're totally fine. And he was like, cool. So you guys are about to be out of business. And I was like, what do you mean? We're like doing super well. This is the best we've ever done. But I didn't really understand at the time that the faster we grew as a physical products business, the more money we had to like throw at inventory to prepare for the next 2 months of growth. And so almost like going from, I think that year we went from like 2.8 to 10 million in revenue. It was like every month we had to like just throw more and more and more and more money into inventory, which is a very counterintuitive thing. Like you're kind of, especially coming from software, I was sort of taught or learned that, you know, the better you do, the more cash you have, the more things you can do. Whereas for us, it was like the better and the faster we're growing, the fewer options we have. And like, we don't actually have any cash on hand, which was a very, very surprising, like counterintuitive learning, I would say.
Probably one of the hardest industries, I think, to scale is the food industry, from my experience anyways.
Yeah.
Which sort of leads me to my next couple questions. You know, like what's the difference from like 0 to 1 million and then, you know, like 1 to 10 and then 10 plus? Because you guys got up to, you said was what, 100 million in sales?
Well, that's between like the
services, I think.
Yeah, that's like between the two companies.
Both brands.
Yeah, yeah. So KNF, we're
so
in like
0 to 1. So go ahead.
So KNF, I think we're in like the, well, I know we're in like the tens of millions in terms of revenue. But yeah, it's a completely different business now than it was at 0 to 1. Like 0 to 1 was myself, 2 employees, and my brother. And like, none of us had a finance background. None of us had an ops background. Like, we had marketing backgrounds. We knew some stuff about that. But yeah, we like didn't really know how to run a super buttoned up business. And so it was basically like, let's just stay in stock as much as we can. And let's figure out how to sell to customers online. And that, see if this is something that like people are actually interested in. And then I think 1 to 10 is like a really interesting stage for us. That's like when we got into retail for the first time. That's when we had to start making smarter financial decisions. We're launching new products. We had to like hire operational people. We had to do some things in that range that were really important. And then beyond that, like at a certain point, you know, 0 to 1, you're like, you have so many opportunities. It's almost like really hard to figure out what, like anything can move the needle because you're just such a small business. And beyond 10, it's like, it's much more of a strategy and financial, like analytical game than I think I would have imagined. Like to a certain degree, you know, things that we would have done at 0 to 1, we could be like, wow, we run this marketing campaign. We made $100,000. Like that's a game changer for us. When you're north of 10 million, you're kind of like $100,000. It's like, I don't know. We're not going to like change the direction of the organization to get 1% more growth. And so you just have to think much more strategically around like, what are the couple big initiatives, big rocks, big strategic like things that we want to take on as a business? And more importantly, and this is a part that I'm historically bad at, but trying to work on, like, what do we not do? Like, what do we decide actively as an organization that we're not going to spend time on? That's been like a big, big area of focus for me personally. And something that I've learned a lot about, because I think my tendency is to like try and do 10 million things.
I think many entrepreneurs, specifically like serial entrepreneurs like myself, have that problem because like every opportunity is like, oh yeah, like this is good. Like, let's do that. And
totally.
In reality, it's probably not the best way to use your time and energy, but you know, you get excited about all these little things that you see in the future being like a huge potentiality.
Yeah, exactly. So
are there any like management tools or philosophies that you've sort of adapted that have really been a game changer for how you guys run your business? Anything specific that you could say like, hey, like once we did this, we noticed a huge shift in what we do?
Yeah. So I think a lot of this stuff is pretty stage dependent. For us, it was really useful having, we operate under what we call OKRs.
Reading Measure What Matters like this week. Like OKRs has been like the huge like game changer for me. When I just saw it, it's like, okay, like this makes sense now. Like,
yeah,
like I was completely. What was I doing before? Like,
yeah,
tell me about 100%. It. Yeah, tell me about how that changed, because that comes from like more of the tech sort of industries where it sort of was born and now it's spreading its wings everywhere. Tell me about how that changed you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say one quick thing, like in a lot of ways, I feel very fortunate coming from tech, like moving into the food industry. Tech is basically like the Olympics of building a company. It's like all of the highest performance, like frameworks, things, everything goes into tech. Cause like tech is pretty much the only industry where in 10 years you can build $100 billion company. And so there's just, the rewards are so massive. And so people are just trying all these things all the time. And so coming from there, like I got to see, okay, how do like best in class tech companies run a growth team? How do they run a team? How do they set OKRs? How do they do objectives, planning, all this, and bring that into the food world, which has been really cool. And I think one of the secrets to like us doing well in the food space is like, I'm pretty sure that we're one of the few food companies that are leveraging OKRs, that are using virtual assistants to like automate various team members, that are using Asana and Slack, other sorts of things. And so OKRs for us, like, we implemented them when we were going from like 2 to 10, and they were tremendously helpful. Like pretty much once you get beyond 10 people or so, we found that there were like bits and pockets of communication that would just like not come together. And so OKRs, and the biggest thing too that we were trying to work on was making sure that everyone is aligned and focused on like the couple goals that make a lot of sense for the business. And so for me and the rest of the team, saying like, we're not going to do these things. These are our three priorities for the year. And then these are like how, and those three priorities spit out like our different objectives on a quarterly basis. And like, that's all that matters. As long as we're doing X, Y, and Z thing that are OKRs, like that's what you're getting graded on. If you do those, amazing, like you're succeeding at this company. I think that was really helpful. Whereas previously, like we got sucked into too many different things that didn't end up moving the needle.
Yeah, like I couldn't believe how like thorough the whole process was from like A to Z. It's like every question I had as you start going through like the way they work, it's like, wow, this pretty much covers everything. It gives us a clear sort of vision to sort of direct the entire company to an objective and to sort of complete or achieve your purpose. So
really, I highly recommend them, especially if you have more than, you know, five-ish people. Like
we're at 9 now with one of our online schools, and we were just going through that. It's like, hey, we're growing quickly. Yep. And we're losing, things are falling through the crack. The focus is like everyone's working hard, like super hard, but it feels like the harder we work, the less sort of things are getting done in the right way, if that makes sense.
Yep.
But total game changer. So cool. So then what's next as far as from like a business? So like, you know, when you grow a company to this, that size, like, is it continual growth? Is it like, hey, let's just keep growing this as big as we can? Like, where's your focus now as far as the food companies in particular?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that as these businesses grow, you kind of go from like, what's next is figuring out, you know, historically, like what's next was always figuring out like, how do we stay alive? Like, how do we figure out if this is something people want? How do we get that next retailer, make that next hire, whatever it is? Now I think like I'm starting to think more, you know, priorities basically move from like, is this thing going to survive? Then it's like, okay, this is surviving. Sort of what do we do with it? And how do we like leverage it to make an impact, you know, make shareholders money, make employees money? Like there's sorts of all these questions that you can answer in different ways. And so I think that I'm trying to think about what that looks like right now. I think that if I step back and look at the food system as a whole, I think that one of the biggest issues in the US, with no exaggeration, is like our food system is completely messed up, and it leads to average quality of health is just so poor in the US, which is, I think, a direct function or result of a very messed up food system. And so for me, I think like I'm really interested in trying to figure out what we can do as a company to further innovate, launch more products, and like do stuff that changes and improves the food system. So I think like you move out of the survival stage and then more into like a strategic sort of like, what do I want to do with this business, and what sort of like the outcomes that I want to drive in the world. And so for me, if I zoom out, I think that like one of the core and largest issues in the US is legitimately that like we have a food system that makes people sicker rather than healthier when they interact with it. And so to me, I think like there is a massive, you know, it's a massive problem, but that also means it's a tremendous opportunity to like try and fix the food system in general. I'm not saying that I necessarily will be able to do that, but like, it seems like a big enough goal that like is personally motivating and inspiring and interesting that like it's something I'd like to take a swing at some point. And so I think we're now thinking about how can we leverage Kettle and Fire, you know, our team, our resources, our brand, relationships, all this sort of stuff to make more of a difference in the food system. So that we're going to start leaning into regenerative agriculture stuff. We're going to be launching products that support regen. We're going to be like doing consumer education around that. All sorts of things like that, I would say.
And regenerative agriculture is like biodynamic farming, stuff like that. Like,
how would you describe it? Yeah. So it's a methodology of, it's like a methodology of managing land that's focused on building soil health. And so, whereas today you sort of have this conventional monoculture, monocrop, like approach where you use a bunch of like fertilizers and chemicals to like extract nutrients from the soil, you know, which depletes and erodes soil. That's sort of like our current model of agriculture. regenerative agriculture is approaching the land as a holistic system. And so using animals, crop rotations, no tillage, no chemicals, and focused on like treating the land as a resource that can be regenerated and built, as opposed to just a resource that needs to be extracted. And so that's sort of like at a very, very touchy-feely level, what regenerative agriculture is. I think that it's like going to be one of the more important trends of the next several decades. And even more so because I think, you know, if you look at carbon emissions and climate change and all this sort of stuff, like our soils have the potential to hold all of the CO2 that we needed to take out of the atmosphere. And what's more, if like the soil holds that CO2, it's actually good for plants. Like plants grow and thrive off of carbon dioxide. And so if I think about like what could actually fix our food system, reverse climate change, all these things, I get really excited about regenerative agriculture and like want to get Kettle and Fire promoting that movement, because I think it's just a really important thing in general.
I love that. That's a great objective. And the stretch would be to like stretch the OKR to something that's going to change the entire food system or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'll put that in a much longer term OKR bucket.
Okay, good. Okay, just changing gears a bit before we wind this up. Called yourself a health optimizer. You know, like tell me a bit about that, what that means to you, and maybe some of like the tools that you've seen that have made the biggest impact on your health.
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, you and I met at kind of like a health optimizer-ish thing. I'm like someone that for whatever reason is just very interested in health, health and wellness across the board. I think that, you know, I think that there's a lot of things that have helped me on my health journey, but I sort of think of the fundamentals as like sleep, sun, your food, and how well you're moving. And like, those are sort of the four pillars in my mind.
I'll add one, how well you breathe too. I'll add that one on top.
Yeah. Well, so I'm halfway through that book Breath right now, and need to update. It's fantastic. I've been very, very impressed and surprised by some of the things that I've learned.
A few other recommendations after too, if you like that, some stuff that can help.
I'd love them. Then send them over. I'd love to give them a read. Yeah. But yeah, so breath is probably a good one. That's probably worth updating.
Well, that's going to affect all those things that you talked about. It's definitely has impact on those other pillars for sure. But anyways, keep going. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. Well, so funny thing, something that's actually helped me a lot since reading that book, I've started doing like mouth taping at night, has been amazing. Like I'm sleeping better. My girlfriend's not mad at me for like snoring sometimes. It's
is your HRV now like 2000? Because I remember last time I met, it was already like astronomical.
I've been doing it for about a week, and I've been doing mouth taping while having COVID. So I'm not sure like the impact yet of just the mouth taping, but I'm definitely going to continue doing it. So excited to see where it lands.
It was super, super helpful. Any other tips as a health optimizer that you found?
I think that the biggest ones are like around managing stress for me. I think there's sort of the 80-20 of like, get your diet right, make sure you're getting food from high quality sources, you know, do what you can to improve your sleep, get enough sun. And then I think a lot of it ends up being like stress management, sort of breath stuff like you're talking about, working through therapy or other methods that just like rewire how you process things in the daily world. Meditation is a big thing for a lot of people. So I've been doing a lot of work there with like, you know, especially this year, like my girlfriend and I have been doing quite a lot that I think has been tremendously helpful for development. Mm-hmm. And like, I think having a good romantic partner is maybe something that is under discussed as like a health and maybe wellness act.
The fifth or sixth pillar we can push breath down.
Yeah. But I mean, I found that like more helpful than almost anything I've done for like general happiness and well-being, as lame as that may sound.
No, I think it makes total sense. You know, like we're definitely very social beings.
Yeah.
And having a partner that helps you to feel good and inspires you to be better, and also a community that does that, I think are two probably the most important. I put those right at the top of the list, you know, and I see a lot of people that are going through like a healing crisis and might turn to things like plant medicine or psychedelics, and they have this awakening or this breakthrough, but they don't have that support network. They don't have that someone that's going to sort of help them as they're healing. And I find those are the people that have the hardest time integrating that experience. Whereas people that have a strong community, I see them really sort of can change a lot quicker. So, 100%. And also like a lot of the blue zones, they talk about this strong sense of community and, you know, like having a partner, I guess, would fall right into that. So
yeah, 100%.
I agree 100% with that. I guess last question, and part of your health is as part of your routine or whatever, you know, I know coming from Silicon Valley or from the tech space, a lot of people do use like plant medicines and psychedelics as a tool and optimizer. So in that sort of health space, you know, where does like plant medicine or psychedelics fit in as a tool for, you know, maybe getting clarity around business? I know a lot of people in the tech space use it as like almost like a nootropic, or just overall in health. Like, does it fit in? Does it have a space? Like, what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I think it totally fits in. I think that it's like anything, it's a tool. And I think that it's a tool that can help people like myself who can sometimes try and go a million miles an hour and not take time to introspect and think and reflect, step back and reassess, like, what am I doing in my life? How's, you know, is it serving me well? Is it not? What, and all those sorts of things. And so I think that using it quarterly or, you know, once or twice a year as a major tool for reflection and working through sort of like challenges and opportunities that I have in my life and that others have in theirs, I think is an incredibly powerful, I think it's one of the most powerful tools. I think that integration and meditation and other things like that are probably like better tools for overall life and like making changes. But I think that generally they're just incredible tools that can crack people open in a way that is really, really hard to do with like meditation right off the bat. So I think they're critical for people that want to develop.
Yeah, because I think like you in general, like, oh, I wouldn't say in general, but, you know, like I like talking to different people from different backgrounds that sort of break that sort of mold of like, you know, the stereotypical person who would use like psychedelics. And then now you're seeing more and more people like younger, older, different backgrounds, different business, different types of experience that are very down to earth, very grounded, level-minded, hardworking that use it, you know, not as an escape, but sort of as a tool to sort of, like you said, be introspective, get maybe more clarity, you know, check back in. Cause I think sometimes as an entrepreneur, you can lose sight of that. You get so wrapped up in the business or focused on growth and, you know, making more money or, you know, achieving goals that you can lose track of a lot of other things that may be much more important in the bigger scheme of things when you look back.
Totally.
And I know people that have spent their whole lives working and then after regretted, like, shit, I wish I didn't work so much. I was super successful, but, you know, like I wasn't around as much for my kids or I missed out on traveling or whatever,
yep.
All these experiences. And I think that psychedelics for me sort of give me that. It's like, hey, wait a minute, you know, spend more time with your kids now, they're young. Or, you know, like be nicer to sort of people in your organization when you're upset, which doesn't happen often with me, but, you know, sometimes I might say things like overreact in the moment. It's like, hey, like, you know, everyone's doing their best, you know, so just take it easy. So, I love that perspective and it's refreshing to see, you know, someone successful like yourself also see the value in things like that. So I guess just in closing, we went from a video podcast to audio here. how can people buy your products? Do you have like, I know you have a newsletter. How can people like get on that? Like where can people like get in contact or follow you or get your products? What's the best?
For sure. Yeah. So I have a newsletter, that I've been writing for about a year now called The Next Brand. Which you can find on my website, justinmayers.com. I also like kettleandfire.com or perfectketo.com are sort of like where my companies live and where we sell and ship our products across the country. So, cool. Yeah.
Are you shipping into Canada yet?
You can buy it in Canada. Yeah, we have. Okay. If you go to like kettleandfire.ca, I believe, it redirects to one of our partners who sells in Canada.
Nice. I guess last question or... you know, is there anything that, you know, you wanted to share that I didn't ask you about that's sort of exciting or new or on your mind?
Not necessarily. This is great, man. Thanks so much for taking the time. This is awesome.
And I guess just in closing, like what's something that you're not doing now that you see yourself doing in the next few years? Cause I find you super inspiring. I'm just curious, like what's on the horizon, like things you've been thinking about, but having to say no right now because you've been trying to, but that you really want to do?
Yeah, I think a lot of, I think honestly, like looking at, we kind of talked about it, but I think the food system is incredibly messed up. And I think, you know, a couple of years from now, I am hopeful that I'm taking a swing, or at least spending some of my time on a system, like a systemic sort of approach to fixing, improving the food and kind of health systems in this country, and not just doing that through like one brand. Now, I don't know if like Kettle and Fire or Perfect Keto are part of that or not, but I just hope that, like, I think that this problem is so big and so compelling and so challenging that it's going to require a really, really big effort and probably some like innovative systemic sort of thinking. And so I just hope that I'm taking a swing at that at some point in the next decade or so.
Yeah, I think you're going to need your brother to reach out to Mark again for round two to help jump on board with that.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Exactly.
Awesome. I love it. All right, brother. Thank you so much for being a part of this. I appreciate you and everything that you're doing. And everyone, guys, check out Justin and all of his amazing stuff that he's doing online. And at the minimum, join his newsletter because there's a lot of great information on there. And thank you for listening, following, liking, and sharing all the stuff you guys do. I appreciate you guys and appreciate you, Justin.
This is great. Thanks so much, man. Have fun, Costa Rica.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.